travels through a kingdom on Radio Kerry with Kaya Flynn.
Hello and welcome to Travels Through a Kingdom. It's Kaya Flynn with you until 7 o'clock this evening, and I do hope I find you well. What a buzz we have here around the Kingdom of Kerry at the moment. There is plenty of green and gold decked out and about around this beautiful county, and it is so lovely to see as well. I've seen so many places here in Tralee outside Austin Stacks Park. We have loads of bunting up, there's loads of flags up, there's loads of flags and signs up in Milltown Castlemaine. I see it in my old primary school, St. Joseph's National School. We have it on our own cars at home. My aunt's gone completely balubas for putting up green and gold at the moment around the house. So it's absolutely love to see the spirit of supporting our own county. And what a week and what a game it was. I was up in Croke Park the last day. My show was pre-recorded and I was up in Croke Park the last day, and those final few seconds would, my heart rate, number one, I wish I wore my Fitbit just to see my heart rate, but those final few moments were absolutely breathtaking. So congratulations to the Kerry team, to Sean O'Shea and to everyone that was there to support them as well. No matter where you were, whether you were in Croke Park, if you were sitting at home watching it, if you were in the pub having a pint with it, we were all there behind them, and it was absolutely great to see. And I remember on my way home as well, we were getting the Lewis back to the Red Cow, and I sat next to a Dublin man and he shook my hand and he said, "Ye were the deserving winners." So that was lovely to hear from a Dubliner as well. And I got a few Vox Pops as well after the match as well, which Andrew played out on Kerry's Full Breakfast, and just the atmosphere of people's joy finally coming to them and the self-belief on what we have for Kerry football is magnificent. So we are very lucky to what we have here in the kingdom. If you have anything decked out and around your house as well, please make sure you can give us a text or a WhatsApp to show what you have, all in green and gold. You can text our usual 083 300 3300 or you can email me kflynn@radiokerry.ie. I'd love to see what you're doing so I can get some ideas for our house as well. I was hoping I could get small little jerseys that I could put on my two little kittens, but if they can stay still for it, we'll have to see about that as well. And we actually have our own Galway man here in the building, Mr. Alan Finn, and he's been decking out his little office in purple. There's a Galway jersey inside there and there's pictures of some Galway players as well. So look, we'll let him have it, we'll let him play with it, but look, he'll be taking him down as soon as possible, I'd say after Sunday next week. So we'll see about that as well. Now, we better get on with tonight's show. We have a busy one for you, so we may as well get stuck into it. Over the week, I travelled out to Listowel, where I met with Martin Griffin to talk to us about the monorail. We will hear the archive of Sean Hurley, and this week's piece is when Sean tells us the meaning behind numbers, and it's a very interesting one as well. And we'll have your comments too. But first, on Travels Through a Kingdom, we are stopping off at the Black Sheep Cafe in Killarney, where I met ultramarathon runner Kevin Leahy. Kevin has already completed two ultramarathons this year in the space of 3 weeks between each other as well. And he tells us about this and his hostel and cafe he has in Killarney.
Hi, Kevin Leahy, Black Sheep Hostel, Killarney. Born, bred in Killarney. I was here till I was 21, and set off travelling then. Spent a good few years in Australia working as a civil engineer. Then I came back to Ireland about 6 years ago and set up the hostel.
Mm-hmm. What was it that attracted you to Australia?
I was kind of a done thing, I suppose, back in the day. Everyone either went to Australia or America. So it was just Australia, I suppose. It seemed like the promised land back in the day. Get out of Ireland for a while and see a bit of the world. And Australia was what a lot of people were doing. And I'd met a lot of people that had done it and had a good reputation as being good fun, make some decent money, different lifestyle kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And obviously then you came back and you opened up the hostel. So how did that come about?
When I left Australia, I went to South America. And just through my time travelling around there, I suppose the idea was slowly developing, slowly bubbling away in my head to do something like this in some place. And the idea of Ireland and Killarney just kind of grew and got legs. And, you know, Killarney, Kerry's beautiful. Killarney's got a lot going on with the tourism and stuff like that. So yeah, it just kind of brought me home, I suppose. And, you know, Ireland's a good place, people are good, it's a safe country. And, you know, you're making reasonable money as well when you're charging in a hostel.
Mm-hmm. So So obviously the hostel is known for a lot of things, and obviously we're in the backyard of it now, and you have a big ETHOS system here. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, look, we, as I say, there's wild bees, there's bees here, chickens, all the veggies, the polytunnel. We try to be as sustainable as we can, kind of thing, running a business, feed ourselves as much as we can from the garden. There's lots of flowers here, we recycle as much as possible and stuff like that. So yeah, look, it's all part of just trying to look after the environment and do the least amount of damage to the environment as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in a background like that?
Not so much, no. Again, I suppose just through a lot of reading and kind of travelling and having my eyes open, I suppose, researching what was happening with climate change. I read several books on it and just realised, yeah, we need to be more gentle on the environment.
Mm-hmm. And how has this hostel come about in Clarny? Like, what was the take to it when it first opened?
It was good, yeah. Look, from a hostel point of view, it was pretty successful on the first year, but again, that's because Killarney, you know, it was in a good location. So from the off, we were pretty good, pretty successful. I think after the second year, we won Best Hostel in Ireland, which was good. It's just helped the business go stronger and stronger. You know, I suppose traditionally a lot of people from Killarney wouldn't have really had much to do with hostels or known much about it. It's not since we opened the cafe, kind of dealing with more of the local side as well, kind of thing. So we've become a bit more known locally, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's become a really big popular spot in Killarney, especially when it's so close as well to the park. So that must have been a great help to you to get your name out there as well.
Yeah. Look, I think during the lockdowns, I suppose, look, early enough in it, we had a little coffee machine in here in the kitchen, and we set that up in the laneway. As much just to keep the staff busy and just to kind of give, because at the time there was nothing open, so people didn't really have any social outlet, so we said we'd do it, and it just become more and more popular, kind of thing, and it's grown and grown and grown. Now it's a nice solid business.
Mm-hmm. You have a nice little bus as well for on-the-go coffees. I saw it there at the Ring of Kerry the last day.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that comes out, we pull that out for a little special events and festivals and stuff like that, maybe 5 or 6 times a year. It's always good fun to pull that out as well.
Mm-hmm. It's brilliant. Kevin, you are a person with a big background behind you, so ultramarathons, where did that all come from?
Ultramarathons, again, when I was traveling in South America, I did a lot of endurance trekking, you know, 4, 5, 6 days trekking in the mountains, in the Andes, stuff like that. I really enjoyed it, I suppose, the long time in the camping, and kind of found I was carrying heavy weight. I felt I was pretty strong at the endurance side of things. So when I came back to Ireland, I was looking for a challenge, and the Kerry Way was right here. The Kerry Way Ultramarathon was right here on my doorstep, so I trained and did that the first year I was back, and then did it again. And you know, since then I've been finding different challenges in different locations, and really enjoying it, and constantly learning. You know, pushing myself in different environments and different races and stuff like that. So yeah, I like the challenge, and I like the lifestyle I lead because of it. And the fact that, you know, because I'm varying it, I always have to kind of research and learn a bit more about whether it's my nutrition or my mind or the gear I need to prepare for some of these Arctic races.
Mm-hmm. What was the Kerry Way like? Describe that experience.
Kerry Way is a great experience. You know, it's a 190-kilometer ultramarathon around Kerry, starts and finishes here in Killarney. So it's full of highs and lows. I suppose I've done it a few times. I've done it 4 times now, so all kinds of highs and lows. But it's beautiful. You know, a lot of people. There's a wide variety of terrain and scenery as you go around it, and it's day and night, and there's a really good vibe around the whole run. Mainly organised by volunteers, mainly run by volunteers. So it's great. Yeah, I'd recommend anyone who's into ultras in Ireland definitely have a crack at this one. It's Ireland's longest foot race as well, so it's a good challenge.
Is it a popular kind of a sport?
It's growing in popularity. It seems to be growing in popularity the last 4 or 5 years, kind of thing. Yeah.
And did you have anyone that was doing it with you, or was it just all by yourself and you just had someone training you?
It was pretty much all by myself. Again, like, you know, there was always someone there I could ask some questions, and some experienced people. I read a lot about it as well. But yeah, I suppose to start it was a lot by myself. Yeah, I never really had a running coach or anything like that. I was just kind of figuring it out by feel, kind of thing, organically.
Mm-hmm. What's a day of training like for you?
It varies depending on what's going on. So like, it could be if it was a long weekend day, it could be 6, 7, 8 hours trekking with a weighted backpack on the mountains, or, you know, like a day like today, it was just an hour kind of strength and mobility session. Tomorrow morning it'll be 15-20 kilometre morning run, so every day is different.
A run?
Yeah.
Wow. How would you do that? How long would that take you?
Up to 2 hours.
Yeah, so
generally I like to run in the morning, so like I'd leave the house at 5:45 in the morning and done by 8 o'clock.
Okay, and that obviously sets you up for the day.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're feeling great by the time you finish, you know, you're back and you're into work and you're kind of miles ahead of everyone else at that time in the morning, and you know, the morning can be nice, you catch a nice sunrise as well, it can be really, really refreshing.
I suppose, I hate talking about lockdowns and COVID, what happened, you know, over the last couple of years, but how did that impact you?
Look, there was positive and negatives overall, like I suppose every cloud has a silver lining. I ended up kind of opening a cafe and adding a successful business to the hostel. But yeah, for me, more positives than negatives. You know, obviously it was hard at times. It was frustrating. We weren't able to go places. I had a race in Canada cancelled. I had a race in Sweden cancelled. So they were pretty low points for me. But as much as possible, I tried to just keep going, kind of thing. And I was able to train within my 5K. And again, one of the businesses was kind of always going. And yeah, just kind of keep it. Use that time to do a bit of work around the house and stuff as well.
Like a lot of us as well. Now, obviously, you had your marathons cancelled, but 2022 you got them back. Tell us a bit about the experience of Canada, at least.
Yeah, so Canada was up in the Yukon, in the northwest of Canada, was the Yukon. A 500-kilometer race up in the Arctic, or just below the Arctic Circle. So Arctic conditions, like it was minus 35 degrees, lots of snow in this particular race. But awesome experience, you know, real wilderness, no phone reception, you mightn't see anyone for 20-24 hours kind of thing, so real kind of self-survival stuff. You pull all your food and your sleeping equipment and everything in a sled behind you. So that was an awesome experience. The scenery up there is beautiful, as I said, that the conditions are very, very harsh. The people you meet and the volunteers in the race and the race directors and all that is it's all just really good fun.
What was going through your head in that experience?
Look, all kinds of highs and lows. I was questioning my sanity sometimes, and other times saying I was on a real high, because you're just surviving in nature kind of thing. It's very, very simple. But yeah, it was overall a very positive experience. I'm delighted I did it, and delighted I was able to do it, had the opportunity and was healthy enough to kind of get through the Yukon and then move over to Sweden and get through the Swedish race as well.
And how did that one, did that differ much to the other race?
Yeah, Sweden, the conditions were much milder in Sweden. It was almost kind of too hot at times. Sweden certainly wasn't as wild as the Yukon, but again, I went into it kind of very fatigued and tired after only having 3 weeks rest from their race before. So it provided different challenges, but again, it was lovely. We were in Swedish Lapland, people were really friendly. It was the first time that race had been run, so it was a nice experience up there as well.
Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of people taking part in that?
About 40, I think, started the race in Sweden, and just over 20 started the race in Canada.
Okay, right. Yeah. And when it was minus 35 degrees, how did you prepare yourself for that?
In those conditions, it's all about layering, you know, having enough of the good clothes on kind of thing. So two or three pairs of gloves, two or three jackets, constantly, you know, when you're on the move, you're generating your own heat. So just constantly moving, or if you stop, then you put on another much, much, much heavier jacket. From a climatization point of view, you can't really do much. It's very different. It's different than the heat. You know, if for a hot race, you would ideally be living in those conditions or training in those conditions for a while. But the cold, I just trained here in Ireland, but I kind of knew I was able to handle that type of cold. I'd been in those conditions a couple of times before.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to camp overnight when you were doing those races?
Yeah, I slept out every night, yeah.
What was that like?
Cold, interesting. You know, again, it's minus 35 degrees. You set up your tent and got a little blow-up sleeping mat and a very good sleeping bag, and you jump in and do your best to sleep kind of thing. But, you know, sleep was limited. I only slept like 15 hours in the first race and about the same in the second.
Okay, wow. Jeez, you must have been exhausted afterwards.
Yeah.
And what you do is all self-funded, isn't it?
Yes. The majority of it is, yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that makes you keep doing these? You know, you're still training. You were training, was it this morning?
Yeah.
Yeah, like what's your goal?
There's no goal. I suppose I just enjoy training. I enjoy new experiences, seeing new places, and again, just being in the wilderness. So there's no end goal. Just to keep on enjoying the training, keep on pushing myself, and see where it takes me.
What was your family's reaction when you did it?
They were proud. I'm sure my parents, brothers and sisters were proud, but they probably just think I'm mad.
Would any of them be interested in this?
Not so much, no. Not the endurance stuff, no.
Okay, right. And if there was anyone that wanted to take on these kind of marathons and stuff like that, what advice would you give them?
I suppose listen to your body, you know, to get up to these kind of distances. It certainly takes a couple of years of your body adapting. Don't do too much too soon. Just make sure you're enjoying it as well, you know. And there's always someone to ask a question, you know, if it's anyone locally and they want to get into it, I'm more than happy to get you up and running for a tea or coffee and talk to them about my experience and help them along the way. I'm happy to share some of the knowledge I've picked up over the last 4 or 5 years, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, and it's definitely inspiring for other people as well. Have you any races coming up in the meantime?
Not this year. I think I'm still kind of just taking it easy. I'd say probably my next big race will be in Finland next year, in February next year, a place called Rovaniemi.
Okay, and what can we expect from that?
That is a 300-kilometer ultramarathon in Lapland again, up in Rovaniemi. So, yeah, like a nice Arctic style race again, similar to the ones I've done, but probably a bit more. They'll be shorter, but this race seems to be a lot wilder as well. So I think you're really left to your own devices for it. There's not many finishers generally most years.
And you're obviously on your own in that sense as well. Does it ever feel really lonely when you're there?
No, I never get lonely. I'm quite happy in my own company, so it never really gets lonely, but. You know, you are happy when you pull into an aid station every, you know, anything between 12 and 24 hours, you'll pull into a little aid station, whether it's a tent in the middle of nowhere or a little village or a little petrol station, and that's quite nice, you know. They'll feed you and look after you for a half an hour, and away you go again, full and happy into the wilderness again.
Do you keep any diary of the events when you're going through?
I don't. People say I should, but I don't. But look, Adrian from Grandview Media has been following me for the last couple of years, and together we're kind of putting together a documentary of my experience over the last couple of years through the highs and lows of COVID and obviously climaxing in Sweden after finishing 1,000 kilometres. So he's busy editing that at the moment, and we're hoping that'll be out in August, September. So hopefully people will get a chance to see a documentary kind of thing, like explaining some of the more details and showing some of the beautiful places I've trained and raced and stuff like that over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. It will definitely be an amazing experience to witness as well. I suppose a lot of people can travel with you and don't see from your eyes, but definitely to see the documentary of what you do will be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I think it'll help some people understand why I do it or how we do it and stuff like that. Yeah, and hopefully it inspires some people just to get out there and just have adventures in the mountains or in the wilderness kind of thing. That's mm-hmm. what it's all about.
Definitely. Kevin, thanks so much for sharing your story. It's absolutely fascinating, and hopefully you can inspire more people. Make a little team of ultramarathons here in Kerry.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that was Kevin Leahy of the Black Sheep Cafe in Killarney and ultramarathon runner speaking to me on Travels Through Kingdom. And what an inspiration he is. Even as he was saying during that interview, that the morning of when I went to interview him, he was training and a 15 kilometre run would only take him 2 hours. And I mean, I don't know, a 15 kilometre drive for me would tire me out. So I don't know where he gets the energy, but it's absolutely fascinating, I think, in my opinion anyway. But definitely worth following him and his story as well. To do two marathons in the space of 3 weeks as well is absolutely incredible. I don't know where you could get the energy for that, but well done to him, and what a story there is. And if there is anyone here in Kerry or listening anywhere that is into ultramarathons, why do you do it, and what is it that inspires you to do it? I know Kevin's story is definitely something that's in his heart, and he just likes to keep his energy and everything like that. But it's definitely, I said to Kevin, actually, he's like the new Tom Crean of Kerry. Because of the way he does it. And I actually got a message in here from Charles, and he says, Kaya, minus 35, I'd be gone, couldn't stick the thought of that being that cold. Brr. Well, Charles, we're going to get 30 degrees heat, so it's either 35 degrees, minus 35 degrees, or plus 30 degrees. So which will we choose? I say we'll take the heat at some point. In that regards. But yeah, amazing story. And if you are in Killarney, I would recommend going to the Black Sheep Cafe. I absolutely love it there, and they make the nicest of hot chocolates, and their hospitality and service there is absolutely second to none. They're lovely people there, and I always am fond of the place. Whenever I do go to Killarney, I do try and get to the Black Sheep as much as I can. Okay, we must take a quick break here on Travels Through a Kingdom, but we'll be back with some comments after these.
Travels Through a Kingdom on Radio Kerry with Kaya Flynn.
And you're very welcome back to this Sunday's Travels Through a Kingdom. And just a few comments that came in there. John Costello got in touch. John was on our show a couple of weeks ago, and you can check out John's wonderful poetry. It's on our podcast section. If you just search up Travels Through a Kingdom on the radiokerry.ie website, you'll find it there. But he says, "Hi Kaya, the win was special. Brought back special memories. Watched at home with my son Dermot. Was at the game when Sean O'Shea scored that winning point from what I call one of the best free kicks ever. There was tears rolling down my face, and there were tears of complete joy and happiness. We are so lucky to be of Kerry, and to live here is a privilege. Nothing compares to it." John Costello in Listowel. Yeah, it was amazing. As I said, I think every single hair on my body in that last 20 minutes was standing up because it was just so intense. But it was definitely such an experience to see as well as that. And Charles also got in touch to say he has his Kerry flags out since the start of the championship to get... They have a fair battering here by the coast, and looking forward to your chat with Martin Griffin about the monorail. He's a good friend of mine, and we'll be getting to that one fairly soon as well. And just another comment there. Patrick in the store says, "Hope you got some cake." Yes, Patrick dropped in some birthday cake for us here in Radio Kerry as well, as it was the 32nd birthday for Radio Kerry. So thank you very much for that, Patrick. Now, a monorail inspired by camels, apparently. The Lartigue Rail was opened between Ballybunion and Listowel in 1888. The monorail design system was developed by Charles Lartigue, a French engineer, and his inspiration for the monorail came from watching a camel train while working in Algeria. Lartigue noticed the camels walked comfortably while carrying heavy loads of panniers on their back, and their secret was each side of the load had to be balanced. Quite an interesting subject, so I looked into this about the Lartigue monorail, and I got in touch with Martin Griffin, who is a volunteer at the Lartigue Museum here in Listowel. And Martin shares the story of the monorail and what it means to him to be a volunteer here.
Hello, Martin Griffin is my name. I'm a volunteer with the Lartigue monorail here in Listowel, and in 2003, I suppose because of my interest in collecting items from the railway, I was asked to come here as a volunteer, and I'm here ever since. So I basically walked up from being a guard on the train right up to driver and eventually a station master and safety officer with the Lartigue here.
Okay, tell us a bit about the Lartigue monorail.
So, the Listowel and Ballybunion Railway ran from Listowel to Ballybunion actually from 1888 to 1924. And at the time, people could only get to Ballybunion by horse and cart, the pony and trap or whatever. So the introduction of a railway to Ballybunion was a major factor, both from a tourist point of view, to get people into Ballybunion for the beaches and also for people playing golf in Ballybunion, because the mainline railway came in here in 1880, so people could travel to Listowel by rail and then transfer to the Listowel and Ballybunion Railway. So it boosted tourism in no big way at all in Ballybunion from a point of view of the beaches and for playing, people wanting to play golf.
Mm-hmm. So there's obviously a big story behind this monorail. So where does it all begin?
Well, the railway itself, that ran for, as I say, the Civil War and the War of Independence here in Arkerry, done so much damage to the railway that by 1924 they had no option but to close and scrap the whole thing, which was an absolute disgrace. At the time, people were saying they should have kept at least a mile of it as a tourist attraction. That didn't happen. So the whole idea of a railway in a monorail being here in Arkerry again was scrapped. But locally here in Ballinagown, in just outside Listowel, in a place called Lizelton, there was a man named Michael Barry. And for many, many years, Michael had such an interest in the Listowel and Ballybunion Railway, he decided to start collecting items that were still left around Listowel, Ballybunion, Lizelton area. And so for many years, Michael kept the memory of the Lartigue alive. And it was a chance meeting then between our chairman, Jimmy Deanahan, and Michael, and they came up with the idea, why not bring the Lartigue back? So a committee was put together then to see what options they had open to them. They collected money, and in 2003 they opened the railway here. So we have a replica engine of the original and two carriages. And in 2018, the mainline goods store here in the store was opened as a museum as well. So from then, we're just building up the whole time, collecting artefacts from both the L'Artigue and from mainline railway. Mm-hmm. And the interest in railways all over the world is unbelievable. And I think more especially with the likes of Germans and Polish visitors, they're just fascinated with the idea of a railway that travels on one track. It's just, to a lot of people, they can't figure out how come we can travel on one track without tipping over and all the rest of it. So it's the technical side of it that interests an awful lot of people. Mm-hmm. So ever since it opened in 2003, we've been successful enough. But unfortunately, COVID then put a bit of a damper on that. But it's an ill wind, because throughout COVID, it gave me an opportunity to remodel the museum, because I was here on my own. We have an absolute brilliant CE scheme working here with backing us up. They were stood down because of COVID, and it gave me a chance to work here in the museum on my own. And the museum is now at a level where we think is more presentable to people and more interesting for people to sort out, check out the items that's on display in the museum.
Speaking of those items on display, there's a lot of things here. Talk to us about what you can find in the museum.
Most of the things that we have here would be to do with Irish Rail, British Rail, and of course the monorail as well. We even have a traction engine that was built by our resident engineer here, Pat Broadbent, and that was under steam originally, but unfortunately now it's decommissioned because it's not certified to be taken out. There's buttons, lamps, all the different types of lamps, signalling equipment. We have a mock signal cabin that houses a lot of items that would have been used in any of the mainline railways. Back, another big feature with the museum is that in 1912, Marconi, who discovered the radio, he wanted to build a radio station in Ballybunnan. So the Stirling and Ballybunnan Railway agreed to take all the equipment for the radio station out of Ballybunnan, except the generator, which was so heavy it couldn't be balanced on the monorail system. So they decided to take it by road using a traction engine. But unfortunately, about a mile outside Listowel, it sunk into the road.
Oh my God.
Which would indicate to you how bad the roads were at the time and why they needed a railway in the first place. And eventually they used steel plates and moved on a couple of metres every day, putting the steel plates on, and eventually, after 3 weeks, they got the transformer out to Ballybunnan, and he opened the railway at the
radio station
in 1912. And in 1919, Marconi made the first transatlantic call from Ballybunnan to Nova Scotia, and which was unusual. The people in Ballybunnan, I suppose, kept that alive for many, many years, but then in 1924 the radio station closed down. And in 2019, because it was coming up to the 100th anniversary of it, Princess Marconi, which was a daughter of Marconi, she came to Ballybunnan and actually made a call from Ballybunnan to Nova Scotia on the 100th anniversary of the first call made by her father. So it was iconic, but it was lovely to think then that there's a connection between the radio station in Ballybunnan, the Listowel and Ballybunnan Railway, and now back here to the museum again.
Mm-hmm. And you have a few pictures above, and you have old radios themselves up there as well.
So we have some bits from the radio station that were survived by a local man here, Michael Guerin. So they're on call, and by pure accident, we just thought, we'll put in a couple of telephones in. And so the telephones now actually turn out to be a big feature, with young kids ringing each other up from one side of the museum to the other, because a lot of young people today wouldn't have seen the ordinary phones. It's all mobile phones. Technology has taken over a small bit. But no, there's a great interest in, we say, the radio side of it, the mainline railway, and of course the Stirling Ballyburn railway itself. In 2013, because the first loco ever built by Lartigue was demonstrated near London, and that's how he started to get the interest in monorails off the ground. And the first loco he ever built was only 2.5 ton weight, and it was nicknamed the Coffee Pot. And that was brought here to build the railway from Listowel to Ballyburn, and they then suddenly realised that a much heavier type of engine was required. So three engines were built by the Hunslet Engine Company in Leeds, and they were brought over. And that small engine, the Coffee Pot, was scrapped. But before it was taken out of Listowel, a local family that worked on the Listowel and Ballyburn Railway called Hollyoaks, Joe Hollyoak, he took the plate off, a brass plate off of it. So the brass plate would have been from the first loco built in 1886. And the family wanted to hold on to that as a momentum. But in 2013, then a great-grandson of Joe Hollyoak handed the brass plate over to us. And we have that here on display as well. It's like gold dust to have that piece, because it's the oldest piece we have in the museum at the moment. We also have, so many years back, a bit of footage, about 5 minutes long really, but it's invaluable insofar as that it gives you lovely, to film the 1916, it shows you how rocky and shaky the original train was, It shows you how people were dressed back in 1916, and that bit of film was found in America, the Ford Motor Company that had it, and it was by pure accident that a girl went working there and recognised the name Ballybunnan from the bit of footage, and we now have it here to show to our visitors as
well. That's amazing the way you do you find it hard to get pieces to bring into the museum?
Not really. About 5 or 6 years ago here, a group of ex-railway, CIE, or merely Irish rail workers came here. And one of those, by the name of Mick Egan, who's outside Tralee, he said to me, "I have bits and pieces for you, Martin." He said, "Do you want them?" I said, "God, of course, I'll take anything." And since that, Mick has been bringing items to me. And what happens here, the stuff that comes in, if it's not presentable, the CE scheme, bring them back to life in the local shed, and then we get them up on display. But Mick, as I say, has been an invaluable source of pieces of how he knows where there's railway stuff, basically. He knows people that has railway stuff, so he's constantly on the lookout for items for us. We're very grateful to Mick as well for his help.
Martin, you're obviously a volunteer here. What is it that you love about this place?
Well, volunteering, I had a heart attack in 2002, and I think my health went down heal a small bit from that. I kind of lost interest a small bit in life. And when I was asked to come here in 2003, because I had an interest in railways, I just think it gave me my life back. Because when you come in volunteering with a group like this, more volunteers and the CE scheme, you can be part of a bigger family. And each other helping each other out with problems and all the rest of it. So it's like a club, if you like. The people that work here, it's like a big club. And I had an interest in, when the museum opened, putting the museum together. I have an interest in carpentry. So it gave me an opportunity to apply my skills, the bit of skills that I have on carpentry. But it's just an absolute interest in saving items from the railway, because if we don't have a place like this to save these items that will be there for generations to come, all these items would have gone into a skip years ago.
Yep.
And the young people coming up today won't even remember what these items would have looked like, because railways have gone so modern now with the high-speed travel and all the rest of it. So being part of a team here is just basically give me my life back, if I could explain it that way to you.
That sounds absolutely beautiful as well. Now, you also have like a mock-up of the train outside. How does that work, and what do people think of it?
What we have outside is a replica engine. It's exactly in detail the same as the original. The big difference is the original was driven under steam, but to drive a train now or have a heritage railway train under steam would be way, way too expensive. And that was seen by the team or the committee that was put together. So they decided to go for a diesel engine. So what we have is a 28 horsepower diesel engine in it. It's in the same in every way. It travels on one track with guide rails and all the rest of it. And we have two carriages then that will take 40 adults or 50 children. And the fascinating thing about that, what people love, is that when too many people get on one side, they love the idea of being taken off one side and brought over. They're just fascinated with the idea that you can't just hop everybody on one side. They have to be balanced properly. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of fun and interaction with visitors because of that. They're just absolutely fascinated with the whole idea of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the modern-day train, you hop on and you're gone in a couple of minutes, but the balance here has to be spot on. And of course children love coming in then, because they get to blow the whistle on the train and all the rest of it. They want to take their photographs on it. But and we've been very lucky now with local schools. They do projects on it. So they start to do a project, they bring them here, then it helps with their projects and all the rest of it. And overall we've been very, very lucky from a tourist point of view, but COVID did put a bit of a damper on us. We were cut for money, but luckily Kerry County Council didn't have come behind us and made a donation towards our insurance costs so that we could open, because you couldn't open without insurance.
Of course. Mm. Finally, what does a place like this mean to Listowel?
Well, when we were closed, I don't know how, I'd meet hundreds of people on a daily basis on the street wanting to know what's happening above. Even one woman said to me, "Martin, if we don't get that railway open," she said, "because of financial worries, I'm going to walk around the store with a bucket and collect money to get it open." So it just goes to show you that there is a great love of between the townspeople and the railway, because well, we lost the mainline railway and we lost the Lartigue here. So, but people understand as well that tourists come here to visit the railway, they're going to go downtown, they're going to go for a bite to eat, buy stuff in shops and all the rest of it. So it is a great bonus to the store to have it here, and hopefully now with the new bypass that's coming in, the traffic will have to pass our door, so hopefully we will gain from that as well. Plus the greenway that's hopefully will be open at the end of this year. We're also hoping that that will bring more tourists back into the town as well.
Who knows, you might be at the end of the greenway to bring people on the train back into the store.
Financially impossible, unfortunately, but whatever, we'll dream on.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem.
And that was Martin Griffin of Lartigue Monorail speaking with me during the week. And Martin also wants to pay a tribute to his late friend Michael Barry, who passed away this month as well, as he was talking about him at the beginning of the interview. And if you're passing by Listowel, it is definitely worth a visit to the Lartigue Monorail. And if you check out our Facebook and Instagram page, you can see a picture of Martin on the replica train as well. It's very cute, and it's actually very funny as well how he has to balance people out on it as well. We also got a message in from John, said, "What a wonderful piece of history and all the time Martin Griffin puts into the Monorail Museum. Lovely listening to him," from John, who is out in the sun as well. It is beautiful, and it was a lovely place to visit as well. And a big thank you to Martin for speaking with me and taking the time to talk to me as well. I know he's busy with tours, and thank God he is, because it's a lovely place to go and definitely worth visiting if you're in Listowel. Okay, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be back with the archive of Sean Hurley.
Travels Through a Kingdom on Radio Kerry with Kaya Flynn.
Yes, you are. And we just got a comment in there from Margaret Ann and Dermot in Tussis. And congratulations to the Kerry senior ladies and management on a good win Saturday. Best of luck to them in the All-Ireland, and best of luck to the Kerry senior men and management next Sunday in the All-Ireland. Up the kingdom, they say. Yes, congratulations to them. It's been great sporting here in Kerry, so it's absolutely fascinating to be watching this, because this is history at the end of the day as well, and stuff we'll be telling younger people in years to come as well. Now it's time to revisit the archive of Sean Hurley, and this week's piece comes from when Sean finds out the meaning of some numbers.
I met a lady the other day and she was wondering, would I ever do something on numbers on my programme? And she tried to explain to me that different numbers mean different things. So I said I'd do a little bit of research into it for her. So here goes. Now I'm picking these numbers at random, not in order. The number 4, that's the one we'll start with. It is said to express the essence of the material world, the 4 points of the compass, the 4 seasons, the 4 elements of the water, air, fire and earth. 4 can represent a moving forward to self-awareness. Now, the next number we'll move on to, again at random, is the number 7. This is a sacred number for many people. 7 is the number of the rhythm of life and the passing of time. 7 stands for perfection and the completion of a phase of development. Life is said to run in 7-year cycles. Our next number now, number 9. 9 symbolizes accomplishment of a creative task. As for example, 3 times 3, it has sacred significance as the number of total perfection and psychic balance. In Christian tradition, there is 9 orders of angels. Our next number now is number 13. This is known as the unlucky number, the number of the traitor Judas Iscariot, the 13th person of the Last Supper. This number causes anxiety for the superstitious. But in saying this, it is also a symbol of optimism and completeness. The restored body of the original 12 apostles plus the Apostle Paul. Now let's have number 3. Completes the human being by uniting body, mind and spirit. For Christians, 3 represents Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And the number 3 has sacred connotations in other cultures as well. Now this evening we've got one more number for you, and that's the number 6. Now it may symbolize the universal struggle between good and evil, represented by the 6-pointed star composed of 2 superimposed triangles. One pointing up to the heavens and the other down to hell. 6 is also the number of our psychic intuition, our 6th sense, in other words. All right, those are the numbers, and we hope maybe to come back to those on another occasion.
And that was the archive of Sean Hurley, who was speaking about the numbers. And I actually used to work with a girl one time who was very nervous of the number 13. She wouldn't buy a 2013 car. If Freaky Friday ever came up, Friday the 13th, she would book that day off work and stay at home. It was very funny at the time, but I suppose it's all about superstitions as well as that. Before we finish, I got an email from a listener last weekend, and it goes, "Hi Kaya, I heard you ask your audience if there were any American listeners. Well, I'm listening from San Diego, California right now. And to be honest, this is my first time listening to Radio Kerry. I tuned in via radio.garden, which is a website, to get reactions to the Kerry win over Dublin. I visited Kerry last August with my daughter, and we visited distant Doyle relatives near Beaufort in Killarney. We saw the 4th of July celebration advertised on Facebook, and now we're making plans to attend in person next year. Cheers, Kevin Doyle in San Diego." Isn't that amazing? Absolutely. And hopefully we'll see you there, Kevin. And if you're tuning in tonight, let us know as well. That's almost it for this week's show. I'll be up in Croke Park next week, but the show will go on here. If you're heading up, make sure you do send us your support, take your pictures, and wish the Kerry team the best of luck as well. Stay tuned here on Radio Kerry. Elaine Kinsella is on the way with 7 days. And then Sean Riley is on from 8, which is Irish favourites as well. I'll chat to you around the same time next week. So until then, take care of yourselves and make sure you paint the house in green and gold.
Travels Through a Kingdom on Radio Kerry with Kaya Flynn.